This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
What we're looking forward to seeing, or what we're expecting to see soon, is a legal challenge in court. Probably the NDC Alliance is going to present its challenge in constitutional court, calling for a recount and challenging the results of the election and calling for an investigation into all of the accounts of the vote.
That's VOA reporter Anita Powell on the opposition's reaction to Zimbabwe's election results. Details next. Also, because they were below the required 50%, Mali's president and his rival will be contesting in a runoff. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Zimbabwe's Election Commission says Emmerson Mnangagwa won Monday's historic election, but opposition leader Nelson Chamisa is vowing to fight on in court. Official results last night say Mnangagwa got 50.8% of the vote, barely ahead of Chamisa, who is calling the results fake and saying he will mount a court challenge. It was the first election in decades without longtime leader Robert Mugabe on the ballot. Violence broke out Wednesday when police and troops opened fire on opposition demonstrators, killing three. Our colleague Anita Powell has been in Harare covering developments. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the election results and the present mood in Harare.
As we learned last night, right before about 1 o'clock in the morning, Emmerson Mnangagwa has won the election by just a hair's breadth. I mean, he barely squeaked over the finish line. In order to win without a runoff, he would have had to get 50% of the vote plus one vote. He finished with 50.8% of the vote, compared to Nelson Chamisa's about 44% of the vote. So he is the winner. He will be inaugurated as president, most likely, because there will be no need for a runoff. But it is important to note that Nelson Chamisa and his NDC alliance are claiming that there was fraud, that it was fake, and that they plan to challenge the results. They say that their own tally, compiled by party officials, shows that they won by a convincing majority. And so what we're looking forward to seeing, or what we're expecting to see soon, is a legal challenge in court. Probably the NDC Alliance is going to present its challenge in constitutional court, calling for a recount and challenging the results of the election and calling for an investigation into all of the accounts of the vote. So that should be coming maybe today, maybe in a few days. It's not very clear.
What is the mood like now that the results have been released?
What I can tell you is right now, as I'm leaving Harare right now, the streets of central Harare are very, very, very quiet. There's sort of an unsettling feeling in the air. People in the capital are still processing this. And it's important to realize that in the capital, Chamisa won handily. He won about 548,000 votes compared to Chamisa's 204,000. So he basically trounced Mnangagwa in the capital. So the sentiment in the capital may not be indicative of the sentiment in the countryside.
What are electoral observers saying about the results?
So we heard from the electoral observers the day after the poll, and they cited some concerns about irregularities, soft intimidation, some issues in rural areas, also problems with the voters' rolls, which is very important because I talked to a number of voters in Harare who said that they went to multiple polling stations and were turned away from their what should have been their local polling station. They couldn't find themselves on the roll. And these are people who say, well, we would have voted for the opposition if we could have voted and we were denied the right to vote. It's interesting to see how that's going to play out and how their grievances are going to be addressed. So there were concerns. The EU, they made the strongest statement. They also said that there was an unlevel playing field in the run-up to the poll, that the ruling ZANU-PF party was able to avail itself of government resources in order to campaign, and that they got maybe a disproportionate amount of publicity on state-run television, which is probably true. Those are the concerns. But these are just the preliminary reports. The final reports are going to take a few months.
That was VOA correspondent Anita Powell speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis from Harare. As reported, Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa has been declared a narrow winner in Monday's polls, but the mood in the country does not reflect the people's victory. Reporter Kuzai Zenawashi has more details.
Following demonstrations Wednesday, when the military shot dead at least 6 people in Harare, police in the capital are on high alert amid fears another angry protest could break out. Dewama Vinga is with the group Human Rights Watch and says worrying series of human rights violations have put a sudden damper on the optimism that followed Robert Mugabe's resignation.
There is chaos and pandemonium. Firstly, there is fear that has engulfed the nation. Soldiers have been on a rampage. Last night, soldiers were on a rampage in the townships in Glenview, Glenora, Kuadzana, Tsivarasekwa, Chitungwiza Seke, beating up patrons in bars, telling them to go home.
Mavinga says they have received the reports that the heavy police presence is in most urban centers. Rejoice Ngwenya is a political analyst and says the situation in Zimbabwe is very telling.
It shows that there is a lot of insecurity in the system. There's a lot they are hiding. I can sense that many Democrats are waiting for some kind of change. This is why there's no celebration. You don't hear people beating drums and you don't hear people hooting.
Today, the anti-riot police interrupted a news conference set to be addressed by opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. He is adamant that this election was rigged in favor of Mnangagwa.
But the result is very clear, it's there. The people of Zimbabwe know. Where on earth have you seen when somebody has won? No car hooting, no honking, no celebration. You go into offices, there's mourning into homes. They're actually shocked. What is this result? Even in the rural areas, they're also shocked about the result.
The anti-riot response was later dismissed by Simon Kayamoyo, a senior member within ZANU-PF. President Mnangagwa has spoken against the crackdown by anti-riot police at the press briefing, which left journalists, like many in the country, feeling vulnerable and wondering what looms ahead. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Mali will see a runoff vote between President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and rival Soumaila Cissé for the second time after they finished ahead of nearly 24 other candidates. Keita had hoped to avoid another round of balloting, but his 41.4% of the vote was below the required 50%. Cissé got 17.8%, which he called a victory, claiming widespread fraud. The runoff in the former French colony is scheduled for August 12th. The poverty-wracked country has been plagued by armed groups, including Islamic extremists, and security concerns shut down 644 polling stations last Sunday. Turnout was just over 43%. Keita won his first five-year term in 2018, besting Cissé with 77% of the vote. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Zimbabwe's Election Commission says Emmerson Mnangagwa won Monday's historic election, but opposition leader Nelson Chamisa is vowing to fight on in court. And because they were below the required 50%, Mali's President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and his rival Soumaila Cissé will be contesting in a runoff. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The latest outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo carries an extra risk. is near an active conflict zone near the Uganda border. The DRC disclosed the outbreak Wednesday, saying it has confirmed 4 cases and that more than 20 other people have died from hemorrhagic fever in the area. Travel has been restricted to and from the affected area in and around the town of Mangina near Beni City in the north of Kivu region. That puts it to 2,500 kilometers from the DRC's 9th outbreak, which the World Health Organization had declared was over last week. Dr. Ibrahima Fall, the Regional Emergencies Director for WHO, talked with my colleague, Paul Alexander, about the current outbreak and the challenges it creates.
We got the first report from the Minister of Health where they talk about 26 cases on 20 deaths, but only 4 cases were confirmed by the laboratory. They are still investigating, and we expect to see more cases, of course, because this is just the starting point.
So how do the challenges here compare with the last outbreak?
It has been a conflict here for many years. It's rebel groups and all kinds of armed groups. So operating in this context will be very challenging because our teams will need protection and they will need to be very careful in where they can go and what type of protection they can have. So basically, it will be the main intervention to stop the outbreak. But the context is different, and we need to invest a lot on the security in the field.
The location is a long distance from the last outbreak and 7 weeks since the last case there. Is there any chance of linkage here?
Our first hypothesis is not a linkage with the previous outbreak, but we'll, of course, do the sequencing of the virus to see exactly if there is any link. But we believe that this is another outbreak.
So how much of a strain does it cause for WHO and other agencies to have another outbreak so quickly after the last?
So we need to very quickly adapt our mission. We were able to send yesterday a team from Bandaka to Beni. So there's a lot of work, of course, again. But this is our daily work.
Will there be anything that you'll be doing differently than the last time?
So we'll be doing the same intervention to control the outbreak. And from the information we got, this is the Zaire strain, meaning that it's potential for vaccination. So the teams are working very hard in Kinshasa to make sure that all this intervention will be implemented very quickly.
And can you give me an idea of what you already have done, both you and the DRC, to deal with this?
So when the outbreak was confirmed the day before yesterday, the WHO team and Minister of Health, the minister himself, went to the site yesterday to interact with local authorities, communities. And at the same time, we deployed people from Bandaka to the affected areas, so they're starting already investigating to have a clear idea of the extent of the outbreak and also to set up the operational site where we can host our people. So we have a big logistic team there in addition to the technical people we have sent already.
That was Dr. Ibrahima Fall from the WHO speaking from Brazzaville with my colleague Paul Alexander. Fighting in Kasai Province of the Democratic Republic of the Congo has killed up to 5,000 people, displaced 500,000, and sent 30,000 fleeing to neighboring Angola. Human rights observers say crimes against humanity have been committed and that the situation may be getting worse. William Eagle takes a closer look at the situation.
The conflict involves the army and two opposing militias, the Kaimuna and Sapu, whose members come largely from the Luba ethnic group, and the Banamura, composed of Chokwe, Pende, and Tetela fighters. Tension started 2 years ago when the Congolese government overruled the Bahila Kasanga administrative unit over traditional authority in several villages in Kasai Central Province. Kinshasa opposed, as customary chief, the naming of a popular Luba, Jean-Prince Pandi. He was suspected of being linked to the country's political opposition. Later, security forces killed Pandi, and in response, his militia, the Kaimuna and Sapu, rapidly expanded their rebellion against the government and its allies. The government's supporters, in turn, formed the Bana Mura and other militias as the uprising spread to Kasai's other provinces. A United Nations official recently warned the situation is fast approaching the conditions leading up to genocide 20 years ago in the Balkans and in Rwanda. Bakwali Ndiaye disagrees. He leads a team of experts the UN Human Rights Council tasked with investigating the violence in the DRC. He says crimes against humanity have likely been committed, but they do not reach the extremes of Rwanda and the Balkans.
I don't believe that the case can be compared to what is happening now in Kasai. Although there is an instant of ethnic cleansing, we have seen sexual slavery. There have been even some instances of hate media, but not at a level we believe constitute genocide. We don't know what could happen in the future, but for the time being, our investigation did not lead us to this conclusion.
Alan Ngari is a senior researcher with the Transnational Threats and International Crime Division at the Institute of Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa. He says the definition of genocide includes an intent to wipe out an entire ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. In the DRC, there is not enough evidence to show that intent exists.
Bana Mura and the government forces erected barriers closer to the villages, and the Luba people were then being targeted and killed. The intent initially was to actually quell the Kaimuna and Sapu group. So it wasn't really to exterminate the Luba people. And that's the missing element. And I think this is why the international experts then said there were reasonable grounds to believe that crimes against humanity in the form of persecution happened.
Bakwale Ndiaye says punishing the guilty will help end the violence. Civilian courts in the DRC are not working, and military courts handle most prosecutions. He calls for more support for the country's courts.
All our archives are in the hands of the High Commissioner, so it is possible to prosecute. It is possible. But once again, there will be never enough courts and enough resources to prosecute thousands of perpetrators. So it should be a kind of prosecution policy, and to select people at a sufficient level of responsibility, no matter who they are, be they from the armed forces, from the militia, Kaimuna Sapu, or from the Bana Mura, and make sure that something is done to at least stop impunity.
Ndiaye urges a reconciliation process that looks at the root causes of the violence, disarms militias, and reintegrates child soldiers. He also recommends compensation and support to victims of rape, the internally displaced, and those who fled to neighboring countries. Investigations must continue into abuses by all armed forces, including the military. Ngari says Kinshasa must begin talking with its opponents in Kasai. The central government must also take responsibility for mishandling local issues involving customary leaders and introduce ways to resolve disputes without the use of force. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Residents in Kenya's informal settlements, also known as shanty towns or slums, are often wary of police and authorities because of their precarious legal status and past abuse. Local activists have started social justice centers as part of grassroots efforts to give voice to victims. But as Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi, justice for slum dwellers is often elusive.
Ruth Mumbi grew up in Mathare, one of Kenya's informal settlements, commonly known as slums, where the poor and undocumented live, and where their legal status makes them vulnerable to abuse. Mumbi's brother-in-law Stephen Gishuru paid the ultimate price.
Stephen Gishuru was a 17-year-old boy who was an acrobat. And before, he was profiled by some police officers stationed at Uruma Police Station as a gangster who has been robbing the community. So one early morning, 17th of May 2015, he came across the two police officers and he was shot without even wanting to know what he was doing in Kiameko, because they had already warned him to leave at the community and go far away.
Gishuru is one of hundreds of victims of alleged police violence in Kenyan slums. Rights activists say most police killings, as many as 800 in the past few years, have yet to see justice. Kenya government spokesperson Eric Kiraithe questions such high figures, but acknowledges police killings have occurred.
It is a fact that suspects have died in contact with the police, but each individual case should be dealt with in its own merit. Figures like 800, I have not seen the individual case they have listed and the grounds on which they list such. But I wouldn't want to dispute a figure which I have not been able to interrogate. But basically, let every case of murder be dealt with on its own merit. That is our stand.
Social Justice Center seeks to fill the gap in data, says Gasheke Gashehe, a founder of Madare Social Justice Center.
We ask ourselves, if we don't do this, if we don't come here and station ourselves here and put some poster there and say stop exclusion, what will happen? This will become permanent. If we don't do it, we lose the whole generation from Kayole, Madare, Dandora, Kibera.
A 2017 Madare Social Justice Center report indicates police killed 156 men between January 2013 and December 2016 in Madare. Kiraithe says it is dangerous for police in slums where high unemployment, law breaking and violence are common.
I can tell you as a police officer, the challenges of policing in such areas are very high. The unemployment rate, the lack of organized settlement, the environment itself exposes the youth to deviant behavior. And what we train the police to do and urge them to do is to, however the challenges, police must remain professional.
The more than 100 social justice centers in Kenya slums pass along daily complaints of harassment, abuse and corruption. Communication and Outreach Officer Dennis Okech of Kenya's Independent Police Oversight Authority says they help investigations of police misconduct.
What these groups also do, because they are at the grassroots level, when these complainants come, because the people at the grassroots trust them, they are also able to direct witnesses to come and lodge their statements with us. They are able to report that this has happened in our area of jurisdiction. But after we get that information from them, we take up our investigations independent of any external factor.
But justice for Kenya's poor and undocumented is often elusive. In the Stephen Gishuru case, the Oversight Authority identified police officers it believed were responsible, but the case has been stalled at the Office of Public Prosecution, and 3 years later, no court date has been set, and the two officers remain on active duty. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and our engineer Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on The Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best.
Yes, sir. Two-Face. NATO C.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.